I don't think you're going to see the more contentious issues being solved.
Lawmakers head back to Juneau to handle the capital budget, with major details still unknown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, July 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, cleaning the millions of pounds of plastic off Alaska's shores.
This is really bad. I think by the time we get done with this little section of beach, we'll probably pick up maybe 3 tons of debris on a third of a mile.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. A Veterans Town Hall featuring Dr. Timothy Ballard will take place on July 25th from 6 to 7:30 p.m. at the Bernard Memorial Sports Center in Wasilla. The event is open to all. The VA welcomes frank and open discussions of veterans' concerns in all program areas. Time will be made available for individuals to address their concerns in one-on-one sessions. For more information, email samuel.hudson@va.gov. This message sponsored by the VA.
The legislature will return to Juneau on Thursday to vote on a capital budget that senators and House members have agreed to. The legislature will meet at 11 a.m. on Thursday in the Capitol. The leaders of each chamber polled members, and more than two-thirds supported calling the legislature into session to consider Senate Bill 23, the capital budget. Soldotna Republican Senator Peter Michicki says state officials say some capital projects were already delayed due to a stalled capital budget.
This budget will focus on the federal match, and the primary capital budget line items where both bodies have essentially agreed. I don't think you're going to see the more contentious issues being solved.
Lawmakers haven't provided details about what will be in the compromise agreement they announced last week. The biggest disagreements in the capital budget were over how much to pay out in permanent fund dividends and how much to set aside for oil and gas tax credits. Michicki says both items are difficult for lawmakers from both chambers.
Clearly, those are going to be the most difficult issues that have to be solved going forward. I don't think they're going to happen in this bill.
The House voted to fund PFDs to the full amount set by state law. That's $700 million more in fund earnings than the operating budget the legislature passed in June. The Senate capital budget didn't include additional money for dividends. But the Senate capital budget did include $288 million more for oil and gas tax credits. The House didn't include any. The Senate transferred money away from the natural gas pipeline project. It shifted $25 million from the pipeline to a fund for public schools and $10 million from the pipeline to road maintenance and plowing. The House shifted money toward replacing the school in Kivalina. Lawmakers have differed over funding for the Northwest Arctic Borough School. Senators have maintained that money the legislature appropriated for the project 2 years ago satisfied the state's obligation for the school. The House capital budget would spend up to another $7 million, which Governor Bill Walker's administration says is needed for the school. The House capital budget also included another $8 million in payments to assist municipal governments. Lawmakers say they'll release details by Thursday. A 32-year-old Washington State man pleaded not guilty today to first- and second-degree murder charges related to the March 16th death of Ketchikan surgeon Dr. Eric Garcia. Jordan Joplin arrived at the Ketchikan courthouse in handcuffs, ankle chains, and a yellow jumpsuit, accompanied by an Alaska State trooper. Friends of Dr. Garcia, along with local police and media, observed the short hearing, which Juneau Superior Court Judge Philip Hallenberg conducted by phone. The case has been assigned to Ketchikan Superior Court Judge Trevor Stevens, but Stevens is out of town. Joplin was indicted on Friday on the murder charges. He already had been indicted on related charges of first-degree theft and has been in custody since late March on those earlier charges. A trial already had been scheduled in the case starting August 14th, but as Judge Pallenberg noted this afternoon, the new charges likely will delay that trial.
Well, it's not my case, but it certainly does not appear likely that a case of this magnitude could be prepared for trial in the weeks that remain before that August trial date on the new charges. And so I would tend to view that as essentially a placeholder, probably, and I wouldn't think that the council should be anticipating that it is at all likely that the case would proceed to trial in August, but that's a matter I think you'll have to discuss with Judge Stevens.
A scheduling hearing with Judge Stevens has been set for 8:30 a.m. on August 2nd. Joplin remains in custody on a $200,000 bail. Prosecutors have so far not revealed the cause of Dr. Garcia's death. Police said in March that there were no obvious causes after a routine autopsy, so a toxicology screening was ordered. The results of that screening have not been announced. High winds swept across the interior late yesterday, causing downed trees and numerous power outages. Golden Valley Electric Association crews worked overnight to make repairs affecting hundreds of customers from Fairbanks to Delta Junction. National Weather Service meteorologist Jim Brader attributes the high winds to a deep, low-pressure system in northwest Alaska that created a strong pressure gradient across the state on Sunday.
Airport, the peak gust we had was 36 miles an hour. We had a resident just west of the university who called in last night and said that she had a gust of 47 miles an hour on her anemometer. And there were numerous reports of trees that blew over.
Brader says a cold front followed last night, bringing rain and continued strong westerly winds, which pushed smoke from wildfires to the west into the region.
You know, this is quite a strong storm. I mean, we have high surf advisories for most of the west coast and Arctic coast of Alaska. This is really more of a fall-type storm, not one we would expect in July.
Brader says conditions are forecast to begin clearing with cooling temperatures late today as the cold front exits. He added more summer-like weather is expected to return later in the week. There were two unrelated fatalities this weekend along the road system. A Kenai man drowned while swimming in a lake near Kosilof. Alaska State Troopers say the Central Emergency Services dive team recovered the body of 24-year-old Nicholas Thornton, who was swimming on Sunday near his paddle boat. Troopers say he removed his life jacket and continued swimming around the boat in the middle of the lake. The boat drifted away from Thornton and his swimming partner, and troopers say he wasn't able to reach it or make it to shore. Thornton's next of kin were at the lake. Troopers don't believe alcohol or drugs were a factor in the incident. North of Healy, along the park's highway, a two-vehicle crash claimed the life of 31-year-old Fairbanks resident Justin Yorong. Troopers report the accident happened early Saturday night near mile 254. Yorong was alone in a sport utility vehicle heading south when troopers say he crossed the center line and struck a motorhome driven by 67-year-old Jack Gannon of Spokane, Washington. Yorong was pronounced dead at the scene. No one in the motorhome was injured, though both vehicles were demolished. Veteran federal prosecutor Brian Schroeder was nominated Friday by President Donald Trump to be the next U.S. attorney for the District of Alaska. Schroeder has been the acting head of the Alaska District since Karen Loeffler and 45 other U.S. attorneys appointed by former President Barack Obama were asked to resign after Trump's election. The White House says Schroeder has prosecuted cases involving violent crimes to fisheries and wildlife offenses in his 11-year tenure with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Schroeder previously served 24 years in the U.S. Coast Guard, retiring with the rank of captain. He was graduated from the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in 1981 and from the University of Washington School of Law in 1991. The U.S. Attorney's Office declined an interview, citing the ongoing confirmation process in the Senate. A spokeswoman says Schroeder's nomination is in the fourth wave of Trump appointments. The Senate still has not completed confirming the president's first wave of appointments. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a love of gardening turns into a business idea.
Didn't really know anything, then got this house and still didn't really know anything, and then kind of had one failed season and learned a lot pretty quick.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Job Corps Center offers training to young people 16 to 24 years old interested in completing their education or starting a career and who meet income eligibility. On-the-job experience is provided for all the training programs, providing students with housing, food, books, and tools. Learn more by calling 1-800-733-JOBS. This message sponsored by Alaska Job Corps Center, Chugach Education Services, Inc.
Millions of pounds of plastic debris washes up on the Gulf of Alaska's remote shores each year. It washes up faster than it can be collected, and cleanup efforts cost millions. That can seem overwhelming for volunteers who are out there year after year cleaning the same beaches. But one man doesn't let that discourage him in the slightest. KBBI's Aaron Bolton has the story.
Yep. So there's 15 pounds of shoes.
Chris Pallister and his crew are trying to beat the incoming tide as surf pounds a beach on Gore Point near the eastern tip of the Kenai Peninsula. Pallister is president of Gulf of Alaska Keeper, an environmental nonprofit that focuses on marine debris. It's been raining all day, and his crew of family and friends climb over wet logs, collecting every shred of plastic wedged in the maze of dead trees. Pallister and his wife, Patty Swallow, are weighing the trash and sorting the plastic into more than 150 categories.
So, you know, we'll have 5-gallon jugs, fuel canisters, nets, lines, and various categories of that. We have all the beverage bottles, which we break into three categories there.
Even the plastic wads from shotgun shells are individually counted.
What we're trying to do is figure out the sources of it. You know, at some point, somebody has to pay to clean this stuff up, so you have to have some kind of assessment. You know, who do you pin it on, or which industries, which countries, you know.
Swallow keeps track of the numbers. The data shows the source of the trash, and also how fast some of these items are crossing the Pacific Ocean, particularly pieces from the 2011 tsunami in Japan. Light material like styrofoam peaked in 2012, and has now tapered off to pre-tsunami levels. But heavier plastics, like Japanese aquaculture baskets, are still showing up. Pieces of the vibrant containers litter the beach, several of them stuck beneath heavy logs. This is day two of a 6-day trip to clean up Gore Point, which is relatively short compared to Pallister's typical 30-day trips. Pallister and his family have been involved in cleaning up beaches since 2002. And he formed Gulf of Alaska Keeper in 2005. Yesterday, they cleaned up 1,500 pounds. Today, Pallister's expecting much more.
This is really bad. I think by the time we get done with this little section of beach, we'll probably pick up maybe 3 tons of debris on a third of a mile.
But I mean, over here yesterday, I think I've spent like 45 minutes in one spot. I mean,
right.
Without even moving.
And you didn't get it clean, did you?
No.
There's countless pieces of styrofoam beads all over this beach, here forever, or until some animal eats them.
Plastic washes up faster than it can be picked up. There are places in Prince William Sound, where Pallister also works, that have 20 to 30 tons of plastic per square mile. The remote locations and mountains of plastic make Pallister's work incredibly expensive. One summer of beach combing can cost about $1 million. What's collected is stored in super sacks, large nylon bags above tide line. Pallister hires helicopters and barges to remove nearly 1 million pounds of plastic every few years. Those projects can run up to $25,000 per day. Tracking down funding for that work can also be a full-time job. Pallister does all his own grant writing and also maintains 2 boats in order to keep the nonprofit going. All this can sound pretty defeating.
So, you know, all this stuff, who knows?
Yeah, it's
keep you awake at night if you think about it too much.
I mean, do you think things are going to get better?
I think it's really going to depend on what happens at the federal and international level. I really do.
Pallister has made several trips to Washington, D.C. to testify before Congress, and he says he's been working with Alaska's congressional delegation. And there are 2 bills related to marine debris working their way through Washington, D.C. Pallister says things could move quite a bit faster, but he's pleased decision makers are shifting their attention to the issue. But until legislative action actually happens, Pallister will continue working to clean up the problem, piece by piece. For Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Aaron Bolton, reporting from Gore Point.
Two Haines entrepreneurs are finalists in a regional business competition. The Path to Prosperity program offers support to small businesses and startups in Southeast Alaska. The contest is a partnership between Spruce Root Incorporated and the Nature Conservancy. This year, Path to Prosperity is focused on local food. KHNS's Emily Files has more.
Right now, we are prepping for our upcoming lunch hour. So we're making sure all of our specials are in order.
Sarah Jaymont owns Sarah J's Espresso Shop. She's served up mouth-watering breakfast, lunch, and coffee to hungry people in Haines for several years now.
Hi, what do you got? You got an espresso drink coming up?
Yeah, I have there a tea, but I need to finish sharing that.
But her love for food started earlier than that.
And I think the inspiration pretty much came from both of my grandmothers. And a fully Italian grandmother. I was the only grandkid allowed in the kitchen because I would do her dishes. But yeah, she kind of taught me to love food and love feeding people. And that cooking is a love language.
Jaymont turned her passion into her profession about 9 years ago when she bought a restaurant called The Local Catch. A couple years later, she opened Sarah J's. The business has grown and seen a lot of success, but there is one major obstacle limiting its growth, space.
Well, the current space is a 23-foot food trailer that has back storage and a 10-by-10 shed. So storage is a huge issue for us. We are busier than our menu and food trailer allow us to be at times.
Jaymont applied for the Path to Prosperity competition because she's ready to take the next step and build a bigger sit-down cafe. The other Haines Path to Prosperity finalist is Andrew Cardella.
There's annual, mostly annual veggies in here, and then big strawberry patch here. There's apple trees I just put in this year, lots of perennial flowers, and then there's some perennial veggies I'm working in.
Cardella's business is still in the idea stage.
My idea is to enable anyone who wants to garden to be able to garden. So I feel like there's a lot of people who are interested but don't know how to get started or maybe don't know anything about growing food at all. And that's where my idea is to get them set up.
Cardella wants to take away the obstacles people face when trying to start their own gardens. He started gardening about 5 years ago with a plot at the community garden.
Didn't really know anything, then got this house and still didn't really know anything, and then kind of had one failed season and then learned a lot pretty quick.
In his application to Path to Prosperity, Cardella calls his garden consulting business Perma Foodscaping. If his dream does become a reality, Cardella hopes he can help Haines become less reliant on food barged in from the lower 48.
You know, that's going to limit how much veggies we have to ship up here and how much the huge, huge carbon footprint that's, that's used for importing all these foods from down south. And then in addition to that, all the plastic that's used to package that.
Growing local food economies is one of the main reasons Path to Prosperity narrowed its focus to food-related businesses this year. The other finalists include a kombucha business in Craig, a food co-op in Sitka, and a farm in Juneau. All 12 Path to Prosperity finalists will participate in a business boot camp in Juneau this fall. Then, two winners will receive up to $25,000 for consulting or technical assistance. Those prizes will be announced in February. In Haines, I'm Emily Files.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
The Department of Fish and Game is opening the summer personal use Red King Crab fishery for 5 days this week. KTOO's Quinton Chandler reports it's the first time the summer fishery has opened since 2011.
It's been 6 years since it was legal to haul a pot of red or blue king crab up out of Juneau area waters and take them home for a crab dinner. The Department of Fish and Game said in a Friday news release they're opening up the personal use red and blue king crab fishery for 5 days, starting Thursday morning and ending Monday night next week. The order is for Section 11A, which includes Gastineau Channel, Stevens Passage, and part of Lynn Canal. The agency is opening the fishery at a reduced harvest level. It will allow each household to take only 2 male crab total for those 5 days. The daily limit is also 2 males per household permit. Corey Marr is thinking about going crabbing.
Well, yeah, it's fun getting out in the water no matter what, but anytime you can bring something as amazing as king crab home, I mean, it's a delicacy, especially when we don't get it as often now.
Marr says he was a little boy on the water with his family last time he caught king crab about 15 years ago. He remembers good times bringing the boat back in and cooking crab right away.
Clean the boat off while you're cooking the crab up. Have the butter and the garlic melted up. Crack that open with some scissors and go to town.
Mike Wiley is more disappointed in the 2 crab restriction.
Yeah, it's a pretty pathetic bag limit.
Wiley says he'll probably go crabbing further north in a different management area because the reduced Juneau area harvest isn't worth the effort.
Well, not if you're just going to fish one area and 2 crab is all you're going to get for the whole season. I'd rather get 1 per day in a different area.
Corey Marr is excited for the chance to relive some childhood memories.
Looking over the side and seeing that red pot coming up, there's no other feeling like that.
But he also hopes that sometime soon managers will say it's okay to get more than just 2 crab. If you're going crabbing, Fish and Game says you need to pick up a Summer King Crab permit from their office on Douglas Island. Also, you'll need a resident sport fishing license if you're 18 years old or older. In Juneau, I'm Quentin Chandler.
Talkeetna's unofficial mayor has died. Stubbs the cat passed away in the overnight hours between Thursday and Friday, according to his owners. For nearly 2 decades, Stubbs, so named due to his lack of a tail, was a regular sight for locals and visitors at Nagley's General Store and the West Rib Pub and Grill. In that time, he went from being a store cat to receiving the title of Mayor Stubbs. Talkeetna is unincorporated and has no mayor, but the title stuck, and news of the feline mayor has made international news on multiple occasions. As time wore on and Stubbs approached his second decade of life, his owners say he slowed down and would not visit the store as often. Last summer, the family brought home 2 kittens, including Stubbs' eventual successor as store cat and mayor, Denali. According to the family, Stubbs passed in his sleep sometime between Thursday night and Friday morning. They ask those wishing to send condolences on his passing not call the store or restaurant. They plan to put together a memory book of letters and cards that are sent to the store. You can find that address at our website, alaskapublic.org. The BBC and PBS are teaming up on a special series of live primetime nature programs showcasing Alaska's wildlife to tens of millions of people around the world. The first Alaska Wild Alaska Live show aired yesterday. About 30 cameras from the Tongass National Forest to Katmai National Park will pipe live shots to a temporary production village set up near Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier. KTOO's Miko Wilson went inside the chain link fence to find out what makes the TV magic possible.
We have a lot of equipment and we have cables running all over the place with these remote cameras, and we wondered whether we should be worried about bears digging up the cables or running through the cables.
That's BBC series producer Adam White.
And we hadn't thought for a moment that actually our nemesis may in fact be porcupine, and we really hadn't banked on the fact that a spiky rodent actually may bring this entire production off air if it chews through the wrong cable. But whether that happens or not, you'll have to watch the
show.
You'll
have to tune in.
White and PBS's Senior Director of Programming and Development, Bill Margle, are leading a TV production team of about 80 in Juneau, plus others across the state.
We've got a great crew that's a combined crew from the U.S. and from the U.K. That's convened here and brought in everything that we need to do and everything we need to make the show, and it's quite an undertaking. We've had to bring in our own power and generating, and that's come all the way from North Carolina.
That generator truck keeps everything humming. Their team has spent 2 weeks setting up tents, a heated yurt, two satellite trucks, and five trailers that house editing stations. They snaked miles, literally, of fiber optic cable through the forest, from tree to tree, through a culvert, under a road, and on elevated walkways. Specially armored tactical fiber, of course, to protect against critters' sharp teeth.
So we have a lot of kit. We have a lot of trucks, so this truck here is the control center.
In the middle of the production village, a pair of semi-trailers, usually used for large sporting events like the Super Bowl, serve as the technical nerve center. Inside, more than 400 monitors display video from around the state, all in service of producing 6 one-hour live shows. One of those locations is Katmai National Park, known for its photogenic brown bears snatching salmon from rivers. The park forbids traditional generators, so engineers modified equipment to run on hydrogen fuel cells. Underwater cameras will capture salmon, helicopter-mounted cameras will look for whales, and low-profile robotic cameras should provide more coverage on land without disturbing wildlife. Land, sea, air, even ice. Wireless cameras are deployed on, above, and possibly under the Mendenhall Glacier. The show is all about playing the odds on where the animals will be.
For me, what's exciting about live TV is that's the closest, I think, that you can get to going there. Because you don't know what's going to happen. When you go for a walk, when you go for a hike, you don't know what you're going to see. That is what is so exciting.
If feeding all that back to the control truck goes well technically, it's still a challenge in the moment to decide what to put on air.
Obviously, we plan out the shows as much as possible and where we hope the action's going to be at any given point. You know, but when we're in there, sometimes our decisions are made. Do we go with this? Do we go with that? Do we stick with this and see if something happens, or do we go away? It's all part of live TV.
John Neary, the director of the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center, has been involved in planning the project for more than a year.
The magic of Mendenhall, in many ways, is the fact that we are perched right on the edge of this magnificent lake, glacier, and ice field that represents a really wild place. And so many people get to experience it, put their toes right on the edge of that wilderness, that it has the magic BBC was looking for, as well as the great access right to a capital city with jet service and all the accommodations.
In Juneau, I'm Mika Wilson.
The second Wild Alaska Live airs at 4 p.m. Wednesday on Alaska Public Television, and a third program will air next Sunday. You can find live stream links at our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Andrew Kitchenman, Miko Wilson, and Quentin Chandler in Juneau, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Grove in Anchorage, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Emily Files in Haines, and Philip Manning in Talkeetna. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork. Wesley Early is our web editor. Zachariah Hughes produced tonight's program. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Boating accidents happen, even to experienced boaters and on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make those you care about promise to be rescue ready by always wearing a life jacket when in an open boat or on deck, attaching the engine cutoff device when underway, and carrying emergency communication and distress signaling devices on their person. Visit pledgetolive.org for more. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.